When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Wait, wait, wait. Before we start, just want to make sure we're clear here. While this podcast talks about sobriety, mental health, and addiction, it is not meant to replace professional medical advice. Welcome to Sisters in Sobriety.
I'm Kathleen.
And I'm Sonia.
And we're ex-sisters-in-law, brought together in marriage and bonded through our sobriety journey.
Join us as we talk sobriety, addiction, and everything in between. You're in for quite a ride. And our Substack is buzzing with amazing content, from creative mocktail recipes to insightful courses and reflective exercises. There is something for everyone. Don't miss out. It's a great way to add some extra joy and depth to your journey. Check it out.
Welcome to Sisters in Sobriety. Today, we're thrilled to welcome Kate Taylor. She is a powerful voice in the sobriety space and host of the Sober Effect podcast. Kate is a writer who shares her authentic and vulnerable personal journey of choosing a life without alcohol after years of struggling. In her own words, she's someone who's drunk her share and half of yours, and she's here to tell us about the complexities of navigating relationships when one partner chooses sobriety.
I read Kate's article, A Love on the Rocks, which explores her journey of staying in a marriage where she became sober while her husband, Nick, still drank. Through resilience and honesty, Kate shares insights into maintaining connection, setting boundaries, and creating a thriving relationship in a new dynamic. So she's here to talk about the challenges and offer hope for those questioning the dynamics of their own relationships after they stop drinking. Welcome to the show, Kate.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on. It's a real pleasure to come on and talk to you both.
Yeah, we're really excited about this topic. And it is sort of timely. New Year's Eve is today.
Coming up. We're recording that. And you're in England, Kate, right? So it is like New Year's Eve pretty much
I'm closer to tomorrow. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, Kate, can you just start off by just telling us a little bit about your sobriety journey?
Yeah, so I grew up in London in a big family, and we had lots of parties. My parents are American, and they had a very open house policy. There were always people coming and going. There are four of us kids, you know, four kids within 5 years. So we were all very close in age, and it was just a big, fun, bustling house. But we had a lot of alcohol in the house, and my father was a publisher, and my house was full of authors and famous writers and illustrators and all these amazing people, and they'd be there for these parties, having these deep conversations, laughing. And as kids, we used to just look at them and just think, wow, it's so cool. You know, Roald Dahl sitting in that chair. We've got Doris Lessing and Laurie Lee and Salman Rushdie and all these people just milling around my house and giving us tips and drawing little sketches, and which I threw away. I know, don't. But there was always alcohol everywhere, and everyone was always drinking and smoking and laughing and having fun. I don't remember people being really drunk, but I do remember there was just booze. And I remember thinking, I can't wait till I'm like this. I can't wait till I've got friends like this, that I can party like this, have evenings. And it's so sophisticated.
Yes.
And when I was 14, I started drinking, but it didn't look like that. It was drinking cans of beer in the local park, you know, and that's what people did over here. It was very much as soon as you could buy alcohol, that's what you did. You went out and bought cans of beer and you sat with your friends. You weren't old enough to get into the pub. So we just did that. And I've always looked older than until I reached obviously about 30, and then I started anti-aging. But when I was younger, I looked older than I was. And I always just got the beers in, and it's just what we did. We sat around, and every weekend we would just do that. And then it would start happening on Tuesdays or Thursdays because we were bored, and we were just like, this is cool. This is what cool people do. it then moved, you know, I got to 18, which is the legal drinking age, and I started being able to go into the pubs and the bars in London. And drinking was just what I did in my downtime. So if I was at school or I was at college, or then I went on to get a job, I just drank. I drank after work with my colleagues. I drank on the weekends with my friends. And it just became this pattern. I never questioned it. It's what we all did. And I could drink a lot. I drank really fast. I got really drunk. I blacked out a lot. I was, you know, I was not an aggressive drunk. I didn't get in fights or cause arguments, but I would slur and I would struggle to get home. And I don't know how I'm alive, really. But that kind of carried on. And then I moved to New York and I lived there. And of course, I found all the Irish bars and I carried it on. Then I moved back to England and I just never broke that habit. Lots of my friends like slowed down or got married or had kids. And I was just like, no, this is fun. This is me. This is my identity. It's how people know me. I'm the one who goes out and has fun. And I wore it like a kind of badge of honor. But actually looking back, that it started to get dark because you'd wake up in the morning hating yourself, thinking, what have I done? Who do I have to apologize to? I have to check my phone. I have to look around my room for clues because I wouldn't remember things. And that's a horrible way to start any day, with these negative thoughts, the fear, the regret, the embarrassment. And I was doing that. I was going out every night. You know, I worked in media as a writer. I was surrounded by people who wanted to party. It was just there. And then, you know, I did, when I got pregnant, I stopped easily for 9 months. And then mummy wine culture came in and just handed me alcohol on a plate. Here you go. We've been waiting for you to come back. And then I did that. I had another kid, the same thing. And it just, I never really grew up. And I realized that I'd been really emotionally stunted all my life since I started drinking. I hadn't developed. I was good at my job. I had a lot of friends. I had a home. I had a husband. I had 2 kids. But I didn't have a clue who I was. I didn't have any hobbies, like literally no hobbies other than drinking.
I had no hobbies either. Yeah. It was like a big wake up call. I remember when I was thinking about quitting drinking, being like, well, what am I going to, I literally had stopped reading because you can't read when you're drunk.
No.
And I didn't work out because I felt like crap. Yeah. The hobby thing is a big tip off, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. So I just, it was getting to the point where I was putting on weight. And I really was not liking myself much. I knew that it was a problem that, I mean, I could not drink. It wasn't like I would shake if I didn't have a drink in the evening. And I wasn't drinking during the day. And I was doing that thing of all the excuses. Well, I'm not an alcoholic because X, Y, Z. But I knew. And actually, I don't think it matters if you drink one glass of wine a week. If it's affecting you negatively, it's affecting you negatively. Mm-hmm. And that's a good enough reason to stop. Mm-hmm. But I didn't grasp that. But I did know. And then on the 20th of December in 2021, I pulled out my phone and I was in the living room on my own. I'd had a couple of bottles of wine and I just recorded myself and I was crying and I was just saying, why are you doing this to yourself? This isn't you. This is a drug. It's taken so much from you. Please stop. You've got to stop. You can't keep going on like this. You owe yourself more. And I was slurring all this out and crying and, you know, wiping my nose and, you know, but actually, if anyone else had told me to stop, I would have put barriers up, got defensive. But when it's me and in the privacy of my own home and I can watch that, no one else has to see it. It was the biggest wake up call because it was drunk me telling sober me, please stop this. And I haven't had a drink since.
Wow.
I never even thought about recording. I think, you know what? Now that I think about it, I think I wrote myself a couple of notes when I was drunk being like, don't do this again. Or,
yeah.
How powerful that must have been to like, to listen to that. Do you still have that recording? Yeah.
I do. And I've shared a few bits of it on my Instagram account, a few bits of the video. I couldn't watch it fully for a long time. Mm-hmm. I mean, I literally felt like I was going to throw up. It was too upsetting. Not embarrassing at all, just really upsetting to see, because we don't see ourselves like that, vulnerable and drunk. We never see ourselves. We see photos or things, videos that friends take, quickly delete them. But to see you know, 4.5 minutes of a monologue to yourself and in that state to actually mm-hmm. see what the reality was of Kate drunk was, but I needed it and I can't even remember doing it, but it's the best thing I ever did. There was something in there that my subconscious saying, do this now, because tomorrow you'll be grateful. And I will always be grateful for myself in that state for doing that, because it has completely changed everything in my life. Mm-hmm. So,
wow, that is very powerful. Really, really powerful. Yeah. I'm so glad that something inside of you told you to do that.
Me too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What led you to become passionate about sobriety and relationships?
I mean, they are two things that are hugely important. My relationship with my husband is important to me, and my sobriety is important to me. And together, they make up a massive part of my life. I mean, my job, my friends and my kids really are the things missing that make it a complete circle. So I think it's really interesting. I think the relationship people have with friends when they become sober, with partners when they become sober, is so multifaceted. It is so complex. And it's like a relationship. Every single one, every single situation is completely unique. So when mm-hmm. people would say, have you got some advice? I'd be like, well, I can tell you what happened to me, but my relationship with my husband is so different to your relationship with your partner. It won't work. That you, it won't follow the same path. Even if you do exactly what I did, it just doesn't work. So I just find it quite interesting to see how people respond, to see how people deal with things. And I think I've got friends who have said that they told their partner they had to quit because they refused to have alcohol in the house, even inside mm-hmm. someone. So anyone who's drinking, not coming in the house. You know, people who live with husbands who are alcoholics, or wives who are alcoholics when they give up. And it's just interesting. I mean, I've always found people interesting and relationships. So for me, that dynamic and how people manage. And it's interesting because there are relationships where one drinks and one doesn't, where both don't, that work, and others have completely fallen apart. But because mm-hmm. It's about so much more than that. You know, it's about, why did you get together in the beginning? And are there underlying problems? Maybe that's why you're drinking. And mm-hmm. There's just so much to delve into, really. So I find it interesting, is the short answer I could have given you.
No, I'm glad you didn't give us the short answer. I find it interesting too. So Kate, I'm a couples therapist. And I am. And so I see a lot of dynamics where alcohol is involved. And one of the things I've spoken about is, in my practice, I don't see couples where one person has an active addiction and isn't making efforts to get sober or moderate, because it's like a third person in a marriage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then I also see these dynamics of when alcohol is like a shared hobby, let's say that's the hobby, how the conflict that happens when people are drinking and the damage it does to marriages. Like I see it over and over again. It's a really, I will also say, it's a very interesting dynamic. I am passionate about it.
Yeah. It's sad. It's sad that this stuff ruins what could be a really happy relationship with friends, with parents and children, with mm-hmm. couples. But we know it does. And we know it ruins your relationship with yourself. Mm-hmm. And of course it's going to, because it's destructive and it changes who we are. You know, you marry someone because of who they are. Now, if their personality changes when they've had a bottle of wine, you're married to someone else. You're dealing with something else. You're dealing with a third person. I don't want to be married to two people. I want to be married to the one person that I did. And that's why it is difficult. And when I stopped drinking, I did it for me. And I think it's really important that people make that decision, because otherwise I find it doesn't last.
Yes.
You have to do it for you. You cannot force anyone else to do anything. And you have to have the strength to say, this is for me and I'm making these choices, and hopefully they rub off on other people and hopefully they can see, but I'm not going to tell anyone what to do. And I wouldn't dream of it anyway, you know. But when I stopped for me, and my husband didn't stop. I mean, why would he really? Because it was my choice. He didn't do a video of himself. He was a much more controlled drinker. He didn't slur his words, you know. Mm-hmm. And it was just like, I just never asked him.
Yeah, I wanted to ask how your sobriety, well, first of all, how your drinking affected your relationship, and then how your sobriety did.
I mean, we met as big drinkers.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually met him when I was 17. He was in my media studies class, but I didn't really know him. And then we bumped into each other 8 years later on the tube and chatted. And then I didn't see him for another 7 years. So I knew a bit about him, but I didn't really know him. So when we met, it was like a new relationship with, we had some friends in common, and we could reminisce about the teachers we didn't like, but it was very much based on drinking. We would go out to the pub. We both liked to drink. We drank the same amount. We could keep up with each other. We didn't judge each other because of it. So it was perfect, because that's what you look for when you're drinking. You look for people who aren't going to make you feel uncomfortable, because they'll go, we've had a glass of wine. Why do you need another one? I wasn't into that. Like, please, just no. I want to be free to drink. So obviously it was built on lots of other things. You know, he's my best friend, and I still, after 17 years, look forward to seeing him. We get on really well. And it was just, when you think about alcohol played a huge part, because we both drank, and that is what we did. And it got to the point, actually, where our drinking was causing so many jealousies and arguments, and it was just getting messy, that we said, let's leave London. And he's a primary school teacher and I'm a writer. So he got a job in Italy, and I just carry my Mac with me. So we moved to Italy to get away from the mess of London, really, and the temptation. But, you know, I actually found out I was pregnant a few weeks before we moved. So I didn't drink while we were there for a lot of the time. But it doesn't go away. You just find other people in the expat community. You find the local bars. You find the same things. And it just all picks up again. It doesn't matter where you go. If you want to drink, you're going to find that anywhere. But I think the relationship, that it was very boozy for a long time. I didn't stop drinking until my son was 12. Mm-hmm. So it carried on, and we just let each other get on with it. It's just what we did. In the evenings, one of us would open a bottle of wine, and then we'd go, let's get another one. And we never really, it's what so many people do over here. No one ever even suggested we might be drinking too much. Not that it's their job to do that, but it was just rolling with the flow of life. It just felt like that's what people did, and there was nothing wrong with it. But then there's just this dark undertone that you start going, this isn't good. This can't be good for me. And we do argue horribly when we get really drunk, and we can't even remember what it's about the next day. A lot of the time you wake up and you look over and you wait to hear whether he's going to say, do you want a cup of coffee, morning, honey? Or if he gets up and storms out, because you don't know whether, did we have an argument or not? I've got to just wait and read the room. I mean, that's not a happy relationship.
I used to do that. I wouldn't know. Like, I would wake up and be like, one eye open and look over. Yeah,
exactly. And it's, you know, and also people say things and then you're apologizing and you're feeling awful, and you're kind of like, well, where did it come from? You must have meant it. Well, I didn't actually. I don't even remember saying it. And it probably came from me having a bad day with my boss, and then I've taken it out on you. And people say that alcohol's this truth serum, but actually I think what it does is it kind of, I mean, you'll probably know this, Kathleen, more than me, because I'm not in any sort of therapist, but it kind of takes tiny little fragments of situations or feelings and it explodes them in the wrong direction. Mm-hmm. And they kind of shower out over whoever you're with, who you feel comfortable with. And of course, that's going to be your partner. It's not going to be your children. It's not going to be your friends, because it will be embarrassing. So they take the brunt of this, but it doesn't make sense because we're drunk and the dots don't join up. So you just, it's just all this crap that wasn't needed, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then also, if the person who is receiving what's being said, let's say, is also drunk, how are they receiving it? It's just fuel for conflict. It's
exactly
just fuel, where you would be potentially, if you're sober, not all the time, but in your more adult mind, you're just not able, your brain is just not able to have that kind of control when you're drinking.
No, and then you get embarrassed and you get defensive the next day. So even though you might not remember it, you try and defend yourself. And it's like, I remember being a teenager and having to apologize to my parents for something I couldn't remember and thinking and saying to them, you don't understand. It wasn't me. And they're like, well, it was you. You have to do it. And I'm like, I know, but it wasn't me. I don't remember it. So it's really hard for me to be genuine and say sorry for something. And I'm saying sorry that I acted like that. But it's very hard to say sorry for something that I can't remember doing and I don't understand why I did it. And they were kind of like, well, take a lesson from that. And that carried on through my life, I think, you know. I haven't done loads of really horrible things, but it's just the kind of little things, they build up over time. And you just start not liking yourself and being disappointed in yourself a lot and having to clear up a lot of unnecessary mess. Why do we do it?
Shame. There's a lot of shame.
For me, a big thing. Yeah.
Shame is a big thing for sure. And so, okay, when you got sober, what was that like for your relationship?
Well, he was always really supportive. Nick was great. He was kind of like, I can't believe you're doing this. It's amazing. Well done. And you look great. And I was like, oh, thank you. And really supportive, you know, and my kids would write notes and he was always kind of like, oh, let's celebrate your 1 month or, I was fine, and there was alcohol in the house. He was drinking in the evenings, and it didn't bother me. It genuinely did not bother me that it was there. I wasn't tempted. It was no more tempting than if it had been, you know, in the local pub or whatever, because I'd made my mind up, and it was almost made me feel more sure about what I was doing because I could walk past it and go, I'm not having that, you know. But after a while, it started to make me ask why he was still drinking. So after about a year, I remember sort of saying, do you not, if you keep telling me how well I'm doing, why don't you want to do it? And it's such a fine line to walk because you don't want to judge. You don't want to force someone to do something they don't want to do because it's just going to end badly. But I was genuinely curious, like, if you're saying how well I'm doing, how well I'm looking, and that I'm nicer, we're not arguing anymore. And when you get drunk, I go to bed. Or, you know, if you get, which wasn't a lot at all. He definitely cut back a bit because he knew all the bottles were his. So it was more kind of like, but if he went out and came back, I would just go to bed. He'd sleep in the spare room. I couldn't bear the smell of alcohol. So that puts a wedge in place. But I started to think, why do you not give up then if you're saying all these things about me are positive? And he's like, well, I just don't want to. And I'm like, so can you explain that? Because I just want to understand. And he's like, I enjoy it. And that's why I thought that might be a problem, because I don't actually want to be married to someone who enjoys alcohol, because I don't want that to be the focus of my life. I think the first year of my sobriety was about not drinking. It was literally about not picking up a drink. The second year was about, who am I? Like, what do I want to do? How do I react to things? What do I enjoy doing? Which people do I like spending time with now that I don't just hang out with other people who drink? And in that period of my sobriety, I started to question it, my relationship, because that's one of the main connections in my life, and started to think about the future. And if I'm growing and I want to start doing these new things, I want to be healthier. I don't want to be with someone. So I sort of said, it's not an ultimatum, but I said, I don't want to be married to someone who drinks every night in 10 years or in 5 years. So I'm just telling you that because I don't want to just walk out one day and say, I've had enough. And he was like, no, I get that. And I think it just, you know, and it wasn't me saying, if you don't stop, I'll leave you. I was just saying, I don't want to be married to someone who loves drinking. And I worked that out, and it was me being honest. And he, you know, I think his drinking did slow down in the second year. And then out of the blue, he just said, I'm going to have a year off. That was a year ago today. So he just said, right, I'm going to take a year off. And we hadn't even had a conversation about it. But he said, I think he was starting to feel the pressure of, I don't know about sort of other men, but my husband, if you ask him something, he'll take a month to think about it. Mm-hmm. And then he'll mm-hmm. think, I've come up with this idea or this conclusion. And so it obviously took that long, but he's done it. And today he's, you know, he'll be a year sober tomorrow. And it has been so nice. It has been so nice to not have alcohol in the house. I mean, he's hardly gone out because I think men really struggle to do things. Mm-hmm. With friends without alcohol in England, definitely. He
for
plays
sure.
tennis, he does sport, but apart from that, socializing, he's probably been out 3 times in the year, which is sad. It really makes me cross that people don't think they can invite people out because they're not drinking beer. But he hasn't worked at all on his like emotional sobriety. Yeah. So when I stop, I set up an Instagram account, I set up a podcast. I went away on holiday on my own with a backpack and I spent 4 days listening to inspirational podcasts, writing what I want to change. I came back, I got a new job. I changed the rest. The sobriety was the first step, mm-hmm. but all he did was not drink. And that sounds horrible. It's not all he did. It's a huge thing. And I'm so grateful, but he didn't change anything else in his life. And I think that's the problem because he says, I haven't noticed any difference at all. He wow. looks so much better, but he said, you know, he has trouble sleeping anyway because of he's broken his nose 3 times. So he doesn't really ever get into a deep sleep. And I think alcohol actually helped him pass mm-hmm. out. And I think because he's struggled with his sleep this year a lot, he's exhausted. But he just said, I haven't really noticed any difference. And I can't believe that. Like, how can you drink every day for 20 years and then stop for a year and not notice any difference? Like, my whole world changed. But it's because he didn't do anything, I think. He didn't do anything else.
Yeah. We've talked a lot on our podcast about emotional sobriety and physical sobriety. And one of the things, like early on in our show, we talked about my ex-husband, Sonia's brother.
Did you know your actual age might not be the same as your biological age? That's right. It's not just about your birth date. Your body could be older or younger than you think. That's where True Diagnostic comes in. With their True Age test, you can discover your true biological age, plus get insights into things like your risk for heart disease, Alzheimer's, and even early mortality. And the best part? It's all done from the comfort of your own home. No prescriptions, no lab visits, just a simple test sent right to your door. By tracking your biological age, you can actually see how the changes you make, whether it's to your exercise, diet, or sleep, affect your health over time. It's about taking actionable steps to improve your well-being. Oh, and if you're wondering about high-profile people taking it seriously, Brian Johnson, the guy who's working on reversing aging, and I watched his documentary on Netflix, uses True Diagnostic to track his progress. Ready to find out your biological age? Right now, our listeners can get 20% off their entire order at truediagnostic.com by using the code CIS2025 at checkout. That's True Diagnostic, TRUDIAGNOSTIC.com. Just use the code CIS2025 to save 20%. Plus, if you subscribe, you'll get an additional 20% off the 50% discount. Discover your true age today.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
And he was physically sober for over a decade, but he was not emotionally sober. And so when something really traumatic happened in his life, i.e. our separation and divorce, within, we think, weeks, maybe days, he started drinking again because nothing else had changed for him. Nothing else had changed for him. The way his brain worked in the sense of how he solved problems, nothing had changed. Just the fact that he just didn't drink.
Yeah. And I think having seen him before and after Kathleen met him once he was sober, Houston, he's kind of an angry guy, right? And so he was really white knuckling it through that decade. But when we confronted him about it, he kept saying, it's one of the tools in my toolbox.
And so I see that in contrast with my current partner, who, when I met him, he was a heavy drinker. And he knew I was sober. And I'm sober from drugs, not necessarily alcohol, even though I don't drink alcohol. But I didn't ask him to get sober. I think he just saw how my life has shifted so much without drinking. And so I would say he's not sober, but and he's from a British background, by the way. So the culture in the family, heavy drinking, right? All with his mates going out to watch football, always drinking. And now he orders non-alcoholic beer. And what you said is really interesting about going out with his friends. Yeah, it's always around drinking. So he orders non-alcoholic beer and he barely drinks. He's definitely in a moderation state, but he's also doing the work outside of the not drinking. Even though it's not coming from me, because I agree with you, Kate, like you can't force it, but he's looking at his emotional regulation, like doing different things, eating better. He's looking at it generally.
Kate, how has your relationship changed in the last year as opposed to the first 2 years you were sober? Or has it changed? And can he see that?
I think it has changed because I feel like there's none of that like side eye. Oh, he's drinking. Oh, I'm going to go to bed. And the guilt that I think he probably felt drinking when he did, when I wasn't. And there definitely must have been some of that. Like, you don't enjoy a glass of wine as much if the person sitting next to you is going, well, I stop because it's bad for me, but go ahead.
For sure.
But I think, it's just been calmer. It's been really nice. We've been completely authentically us for a year. There's the arguments that we've had are proper arguments for a reason. And I feel the same way the next day. And we resolve them and we learn something about each other and about ourselves and about our relationship. You know, arguments are healthy if they're the right arguments. I'm not, I love you every day. And we go around like pretending, but we do get on very well, but we're different people. We're very different people, which is part of the reason I like him, because I'm still learning things out about him. And, you know, not to sound like a hussy, but I got pregnant within like a few months of our first date. And then I ended up having a baby and giving birth in Italy, where I don't speak Italian. So again, that's another conversation for another day offline. But it was, it's been a great journey with him. And I've always said, and I don't believe there's one person for everyone. I think we change a lot. I've always said to him, if you ever go off me, just tell me, don't cheat on me. Just tell me, I will get it. There are other people out there that I would be happy with. I'd be happy on my own. If you find someone else, the last thing I want you to do is think you should stay with me. So, and he's like, you almost sound like you want me to go. I'm like, no, I don't believe in this whole let's stay together. Life's too short. Yeah. And I believe that. And I've always said, if things stop working, then they stop working and we move on, because life should be like that, you know, and we should be assessing everything in our lives constantly, not obsessively, but we should constantly say, am I happy with this? Am I happy with that? And if not, what can I change? And my worry is that he will start drinking again as of tomorrow. Mm-hmm. But he said he's not going to drink at home. He might drink a couple of beers when he goes out. And I have no idea how it's going to unfold. It could be incredible. He could decide, actually, I've had a night of drinking and I preferred it when I didn't. Mm-hmm. And actually, I've realized what you've said about nothing else has changed. And that's what I want to do. Or he could start drinking and every night and we've broken up in a year. I don't know. But all I can say is that I know what I'm doing. I'm very honest about my relationship with myself and with him. And while I don't give ultimatums, I tell my truth about how I'm feeling, and he can take it or leave it, but there will be no surprises. And I think that's, you have to be fair. You have to tell people along the way how you're feeling, because if you pull these cards out from nowhere and go, you've been doing this for 3 years and it's been driving me mad and it's been boiling up and now I'm exploding. It's kind of, I'd want to know. And I'm hoping that it will go the first way. But if it goes the other way, that's his choice. And it's just how things are. You know, I love him and I hope it'll work, but I don't want to be married to someone who changes or who gets more depressed or more anxious. And it is in the morning as well. It's not just the period that they're drinking. It's the next day. It's snappiness.
For days, Kate.
Yeah. And we know that because we did it. So it affects everything. And it's, I think what it comes down to is I can't bear to watch someone I love hurting themselves. And that's what I feel like alcohol does now. I don't like to see people change. I find it really uncomfortable when people get drunk who are my friends and I have to watch them become sloppy, repeat themselves, get annoying. And I respect them and I love them so much. You know, I find it uncomfortable and I have to leave. I can't leave my home. So I don't know what he will choose, but it won't be between me and alcohol. It will be between himself and alcohol or himself and a different life. And hopefully it will work out. But who knows?
That's really vulnerable and courageous for you to talk so openly about this. Like, given that today is the day that he is his like 1 year, right? Today or tomorrow. And so have you been having like ongoing conversations about this? Or is this like today he was like, oh, by the way, Kate, I am going to start drinking again.
No, I asked him about 2 months ago, are you going to start drinking? And he went, probably, yeah. He's just very flippant about it. And I don't know what's going on in his head. And he's not the kind of person, I mean, he's never going to listen to this, by the way. I don't think he'd probably love me talking. I'm not saying anything that he doesn't know, though. So it's fine if he does. But he's, I don't want to push him. It's private. Some people find it really uncomfortable to talk about things. He knows he can talk to me about it. I don't, and I just asked him if he was. And he has always said, I think I will. And then today he brought it up and just said, I'm not going to drink at home at all. I think he's worried about disappointing me because I have said repeatedly that I've loved having him not drink and that he can tell that we get on better. He can tell we laugh more and there's no arguments, you know, as I said, unless there are arguments about things that you need to argue about or have out. But it's very hard when someone is not a talker. I am a talker and he is not. He finds it very hard to talk about his feelings. I think he finds it hard to decipher his own feelings, to be honest. And it will be a question of him taking a step and seeing how he goes and assessing along the way. And I'm just a spectator, really, and hopefully a consideration in it. But I don't want to be a main consideration. I want this to be for him or I'll be resented. And that will lead us down another dangerous, unhealthy path. So
Kate, like let's look at it from two perspectives. I was resented, right? So when I quit, my ex just kind of felt like he had to stop drinking and smoking weed. And we didn't have that conversation. And I thought it was something he wanted to do, right? And for his health. And I thought it was pretty obvious that he wasn't doing the emotional work, but didn't say anything. So I want to ask Kathleen, what is a way in either situation, how can we have these conversations? I wish I had had the conversation looking back, because one of the last things this asshole said to me was, I can't even drink. And it was like, who told you couldn't drink? No one ever said. And so there is that when you don't talk about it, I think he resented me still, even though I didn't push it, he resented me. Mm-hmm. So Kathleen, what can we do to have these conversations in a more...
I think they're difficult conversations to have, right? But it's like having them when tensions aren't high. So when you're not already pissed off about something else, or there's not already like... when your ex was already being like, I can't even drink. Like, that's not the time. The time is like months or a year before that to have,
you know, that was like he had his suitcase and he was walking out the door. Yeah. So it wasn't like,
I think I often tell the couples I see, it's really important to differentiate what you're seeing in front of you as fact and what is the story you're telling yourself. And for your ex, Sonia, there wasn't any fact. The only fact was that my wife no longer drinks anymore. But the story he was telling himself was, because my wife no longer drinks anymore, that means I can't have fun, or I can't go out. Or so it's differentiating, like, what is the truth? Like, what is the fact? And then what is the story that they're telling themselves? And so I often will ask couples, not just about drinking, but what's the fact first? Tell me what the fact is, as if a video camera is in the room. What's the fact? What's happening? So for Kate, like, this example would be like, Nick's no longer drinking, or Nick is starting to drink out of the home, or he has said that. It's not, we don't even know that yet. And then what's the story we're telling ourselves about that? So Sonia, in your case, like I mentioned, the story that your ex was saying was all this other stuff. How do you feel about it? Usually our feelings come from the story we've created about something, not the actual fact about something. And then it's getting really clear on what do you want. For your ex, Sonia, I'm just imagining what he would want is, I want to be able to go out and drink and have fun. Well, fine. Okay. But there was no communication about it. So sometimes we get trapped in the story so deeply that we think the story is fact. And so we can't possibly have these conversations with our partners because, well, it's the story. No. What is the fact? And then what is the story? And communicating that.
Do you know what I do a lot? Mm. And maybe it's because I'm a writer, but I write letters. Mm-hmm. So I will write how I feel, because if you say it and someone's standing there, they automatically get defensive, feel awkward, feel like they've got to reply, feel like you're trying to read them. You're expecting an answer. And with my husband, he won't have an answer there. He needs to go away and comprehend what I've said and think about what he thinks and then put it together and come back to me. And that's how he is. So if I write down, this is how I feel, this is why I feel this way, and I wanted you to know that, and then I'll give him the letter, and then I'll just get on with my day, and he can take it, he can read it when he's ready, he can digest it when he wants, I'm not there looking at him, he can really think about it, and then he can say, and he always does, and I don't write him lots of letters. I mean, maybe I've done that 4 or 5 times in 17 years, but when there's something I need to say and I don't think a conversation will work, it's a very good way, because they can reread it and they can understand it, and you haven't got that tone in your voice, that desperation, or I need you to listen to me. And you can think about it, you can rewrite it until you've got it bang on and give it to them, and they can understand it with some space and some breathing space, you know? So for me, that works as well.
Mm-hmm. I think it's a really good option. I think any communication, I find text messaging the lowest form of communication, so I don't recommend that. But and there's too much that can get in the way of that. But it's interesting you say that, Kate, because I have a daughter who has challenges voicing her emotions. Oof. And so we have started writing each other letters. Like, we live in this house, and she's 10, but we write each other letters, and she's able to open up so much more because she can be thoughtful about it, and then I can be thoughtful about it. So absolutely, I think that's a great way to do it. And just to answer your question, Sonia, the communication about this is ongoing. It shouldn't be like at the end when the bags are packed, oh, you know, I couldn't drink, so I gotta go. It's like Kate, you said, there's no surprises here. You've said, like, your piece in terms of, like, this is what you want for yourself. There's no surprises here. And I think that, to me, as a couples therapist, is what you want. You don't want there to be surprises. Like, you want, this is how I feel. This is what is my truth. This is what I need. This is what I hope for in our relationship. And that's your responsibility. And then Nick's responsibility is something else.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, who likes to hear the words, we need to talk? I need to talk.
No one.
It's like fear of God comes into your body. But if you don't leave it to the point where you need a really serious conversation about it, if you talk about things as they happen and as you feel them, it's so much easier to digest, and people feel like they know where they stand, you know, and it's like the whole friendship thing. People don't invite me out much. You know, I got asked out twice over the Christmas break. I was asked out every night 3 years ago. I'd be out every night, and it's hard. But actually, have I told them? that I'm still okay going out to the pub? No. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Have I invited them out? No. So mm-hmm. why am I annoyed that they're not inviting me? They don't know how to deal with sober Kate. I've always been a drinker. It's so important to talk and to think about things and just explain, because when people understand, then they can make an action. They can decide what they want to do with all the facts in front of them. Mm-hmm. And actually, that's all I'm doing. I'm laying my feelings out, saying, this is how I feel. And then he can do the same. And if they're compatible, fantastic. Mm-hmm. And if they're not, good luck. And I wish you all the best. But I'm not going to hang around in a relationship that makes me feel uncomfortable or makes me feel like I'm with someone who's self-harming. Because mm-hmm. I really do see excessive drinking like that now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm. No, I definitely agree. And it sounds like you have such a good way forward and approach.
Well, then if you speak to me in a year and I'm sobbing, you'll need to give me some free counseling. I was like, fine. I got it wrong.
That's fine. That's fine. We can do that too.
No, I think
we could do it 1 year later. Yeah.
You've just got to be honest. Life changes. People change.
They
Thank
do.
Thank goodness. They do. And it makes people interesting and it makes life interesting. Different people are right at different times. Different relationships come and go. And just because they go doesn't mean they weren't valid and they weren't useful and they weren't right at the time. It's not a waste. Even if we don't end up together, it doesn't mean this 17 years has been wasted at all. And I just think people need to take it less seriously and just see it as a journey that is constantly evolving, rather than I've got my list. This is what I need to do in my life. And if it doesn't all get ticked off, I'm a failure. I mean, why would you do that to yourself? You know,
I'm mm-hmm. still working on that. Like, I felt like the 18 years were a waste for a long time.
Yeah.
It's still, and now I'm starting to understand the concept of journey. I will say, yeah. Kate, you say it now, but dating sober is it's a hell, like, all of its own.
Yeah, I think I'd probably be single.
Yeah.
I think mm-hmm. I love my own company and I love my friends.
Me too.
So, I have so many friends who are single and they're all dating in different ways. And it's
horrifying.
It's, well, some of it's lovely. Some of my friends have met husbands on, you know, what are they like when you write into the paper, you know, they don't use the, all these awful apps, but there are some that you pay for and they match you much more, you know, compassionately, like they take time.
Yeah.
And one of my friends, my old business partner, just got married to her husband who she met on one of those things. So,
okay, speaking of, can we just like have a quick discussion about intimacy when you're sober? So I'm not sure I had ever been intimate sober before I got sober.
Oh no, I'd never had sex sober. If you think alcohol is in your system for 12 hours after you've drunk, no, not until this time. And it's hard, actually, it feels almost embarrassing when you're sober mm-hmm. for someone who has always drunk and when they've taken their clothes off, you know, it feels suddenly like, oh my gosh, mm-hmm. I found it really difficult. And I'm not going to give you the kind of, it's amazing, it's the best sex of my life, because actually it is something I still struggle with.
Really?
And yeah, it is. But I think that's to do with me.
For sure.
And maybe my history and shame mm-hmm. and how I feel about myself. I don't think it's to do with the fact sex is worse. Of course it's better because you're actually, your brain's working. But I think there's a lot of other stuff in there. And I think when you stop drinking, you deal with things. And, you know, having had 25 years of drinking means that, you know, there's a lot of shame there and a lot of things that are in my mind that do surface, and the way that I see myself, you know, I really was negative about myself for so long. So it's very hard to go, I'm beautiful, I'm sexy. And it takes time, but I think there's definitely nothing to be scared of. I think it is better, but you really do have to start in a way from scratch. But then everything you do, everything you feel is so much heightened when you're not drinking.
Yes.
So it's all going to be better, isn't it? But you've just got to overcome lots of different things in your life so that you feel comfortable. But yeah, I'm probably not the best person to ask about that, because I do think there are still, I don't really know how to say it, but I've got a few, I think my history and sleeping with people who I didn't really want to or wouldn't have, all these memories are still in my head. I still have a lot of shame about them. Situations where I've been taken advantage of because I've been drinking that are really sad and very hard things to talk about or come to terms with. Those are all still up there, and I still associate those with having sex. So until I can properly separate them, I'm not jumping into bed every 5 minutes. But absolutely sex is better because you're fully aware of yourself, you know, with your skirt halfway around your neck, you know, it's better. But yeah.
No, I think you are the right person to talk about it, because I think that that is like the common story, right? For all of us who started drinking in our teens, is that a lot of it was to get rid of insecurity.
Yeah.
And like body issues. And so it's actually, it's nice to hear someone not say, oh, it's so much better. And we're like so connected. Really? Because I'm still like wondering what's going on with this like flap of skin, like that I didn't when I was drinking wasn't.
No, you don't
as
care.
Aware. Yeah.
And it's not my body. Like I've always been perfectly fine with my body. And maybe it's because I'm 5'11". And so I'm like a giraffe. So I'm,
so is Kathleen.
Know, I am too.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
No, I'm always a bit like, there's so much of me. I need a caveman. And those people don't care if you've got a few extra.
It's true.
That's a real generalization. But yeah, I think it's mental for me. It's a mental block and a mental thing I need to get over. Because I think I still associate it with a lot of shame and anger and all sorts of things. Mm-hmm. So it's about me. And actually, I interviewed a sex therapist on my podcast before we finished it. And she was fascinating. And actually, you might want to get her on, because she was really interesting and talking about ways to have sober sex and what you need to do and the challenges. It was a really interesting conversation. So,
yeah, we're going to have her on.
She's very, she loves talking about it. So unlike most people who get embarrassed, she's like, yeah, what do you want to know? It's my favorite topic.
I feel like Kathleen and her together will be something.
Yeah, it's true. I do love talking about sex a lot. That's
Is there
sure.
a
yeah.
difference between a sex therapist and a relationship therapist?
Oh, yeah.
Like, do you do sex therapy or no?
Oh, no. She's literally talking about all sorts of like vibrators and you should do this. And it's about physically having intercourse. What she's
and sex
about.
Therapists actually are like, there's like a whole other like regulation around sex therapists. So what's next for you, Kate?
I'm focusing on my career at the moment. I've just gotten my first full-time job after 15, 16 years as a freelancer. So that's exciting.
That is.
Yeah. And I just want to focus on me now. I feel like I've got catching up to do. I feel like I've wasted a lot of time because I have. And I really want to expand my brain, my skills. I want to learn more. I want to see more. I want to meet more people. I am interested in more. And I just need to get enough money to be able to do those things. But the career is being part of a team, being reliable, being able to work, you know, from the moment I get up and or turn my computer on and I'm there. I'm not ever hungover. I'm absolutely loving it. So I think... It's life. It's making the most of life and making sure when it comes to an end, I look back and go, I gave it my best shot.
I still get that feeling. Like this morning, I had that feeling. I went out with my nieces last night and didn't go to bed till later and like woke up at like 6:30, like, let's record the podcast. Normally, if I were out like the night before, I would be a disaster, right? And so I still really appreciate it. So, okay, Kate, I'm making a note. We're going to have you back a year from today.
Oh, okay. Brilliant.
You report back.
Here's my new boyfriend.
I'll do a live couple session or individual session.
Depending. But I hope we're together. And I if I were to bet, I'd say we would be, because I think if anything, being in a relationship where we both drink, then when one of us drinks, then when neither of us drink, we've been through all of it and we can see the signs, we can see what doesn't work, and we are both really caring people who aren't selfish. So actually, with all of that information under our belt, we should be able to navigate a healthy relationship going forward, you know. So I would definitely come back though and fill you in.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for coming on today.
Thank you for having me. It's been an absolute pleasure. It really has.
And thank you for listening to Sisters in Sobriety, and we will see you next week.
This was Sisters in Sobriety.
Thank you for listening and being with us today.
If you want to learn more about sobriety and meet your community, find us at sistersinsobriety.substack.com.
Are you a sister in sobriety? Then reach out on social media. We'd love to hear from you.
If you're feeling generous, leave us 5 stars and a review and follow us wherever you listen.
You'll never miss an episode. Until next time.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.